This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
With licensed psychologist and guest John Delatorre.
Jennifer Soto claiming that her last conversation with Maddie was the night before her disappearance. In another interview, it was the morning, seeing her getting ready for school. Again, everybody grieves differently. Memories can be faulty, but that wasn't the only inconsistencies. There were several others. If you watch some of the interviews, one, she says, we dropped her off at school, then it's he dropped her off at school. The timelines do not match up at all with the times that she was claiming that the girl was dropped off, and we're now learning that she was never dropped off. The idea of this camera, we'll get to that in a second. But let's talk about the inconsistencies in those statements. Could this be a mother who has her mind blown right now because her daughter is missing and just everything's, you know, discombobulated in her mind? Or is this someone who just really, you know, she has a story that she's trying to sell, but may not be the best seller of that story?
Yeah, I think it's the second one. I think she's trying to sell a story that's not her story to sell. I think she is being fed a story to sell. I think she recognizes probably some elements of her own complicity in the disappearance and subsequent murder of her daughter. I think there are a lot of things at play. Now, you can certainly have, you know, in your trauma response, you can certainly have elements in which your story isn't quite lining up, but not knowing when the last time that you had the conversation, it's one thing to mess up the contents of the conversation. It's another thing to mess up the timeline of when that conversation actually occurred. So there's a story that she's trying to tell the audience, but also herself. Mm-hmm. There's some elements of trying to convince everyone that there's nothing to see here, but she's doing it very, very poorly, probably because she knows that something very bad happened here.
It was an interesting piece of this story. Early on, Jen Soto was claiming that they or she or he, or because again, it's been both, had dropped their daughter off or her daughter off across the street from the school. Maybe she was embarrassed. I mean, it was a very detailed response, and I get it. You're 13. I didn't want to be seen with my parents either. Most kids don't. But that was a story that she was telling because authorities had told, I believe, her sister that they had surveillance video of this happening, of her daughter getting out of that vehicle and then walking along, we were hanging out in the church parking lot, going off camera, then that was the last they saw of her. Reality that we've now learned through some other affidavits that have come out, some kind of redacted. They didn't do the greatest job redacting because you can put some pieces together on this. The timeline doesn't add up at all. In fact, they're saying that Maddie was dead in the car, it appears, never was dropped off. There's surveillance footage of her boyfriend throwing items of hers into a dumpster. But that idea that she was dropped off apparently never actually happened. Do you think that was a part of the investigation or part in the ploy in the investigators to give them some information? Because in the U.S., you are allowed to lie. Police can lie to potential suspects about what's going on to elicit information. Do you think that was part of a story that they were giving them to say, oh yeah, she was dropped off. What do you have to say about that? Considering if he knows what happened, because he's in the vehicle, maybe she doesn't, but I don't know, I'm thinking maybe she does. We're going to say we have her on camera getting out of that car. That could throw you for a bit of a loop if you know she did not get out of that car to walk to school.
Yeah, absolutely. That's certainly a technique for police to use to see how they're going to respond and how the story changes. In order to make a successful lie, it has to have an element of truth. But if you're trying to if you're the liar, you're trying to hide that, you know, you actually did something bad, then you can't reveal too much of the truth. So it's certainly possible that it was a ploy by the police to try to figure out which of the two is really at fault here. Mm-hmm. And then once they decide, once all this other stuff came out, the phone and everything like that, once all this stuff, then the police could actually start making a targeted response and how they're going to interrogate the boyfriend.
In a bit of broader strokes, you watched those interviews. What was your, you know, psychological, you know, for what you can, you know, evaluation of mom? I mean, just in the layman, my sense is there was an extreme lack of empathy. It was kind of shocking. It seemed that she was able to, you know, on cue, get her voice pretty high, really didn't see any true tears. It felt like kind of bad acting. What was your take on the interviews when she was pleading for her daughter's safe return?
I watched them in this order. I watched the one where there's a camera crew inside the house first. Mm-hmm. And then I watched the one that was done virtually. That's the one with the boyfriend sitting in the background. Mm-hmm. In the one with the boyfriend sitting in the background, I certainly saw all of that. I certainly saw the sort of cold, aloof, sort of detached way manner that seemed inconsistent with a mother whose child has gone missing and they don't know what happened to that child. In the first interview, I saw someone, and I've seen this before, with someone who has a high level of anxiety, constantly having a tremor. Mm-hmm. That's what I expected to see in the subsequent interviews that I didn't see. I expected her to continue to have that anxiety tremor. And again, no, she wasn't crying. But my point is that the boyfriend wasn't there during the anxiety tremor interview. That's the one where the camera crew is inside and she's struggling to really answer all these questions. So it suggests then that the story that either they both came up with together or the story that he wants her to tell hadn't been crystallized yet. It hadn't been formalized yet. So she's very nervous about revealing information that might be detrimental to them. And again, I understand that we're talking about a missing and murdered child. I get that. But that's not what's happening in their heads, right? For them, the child isn't missing. The child is already dead. So now they're trying to mitigate their culpability and their responsibility, either because she is complicit or because the boyfriend is telling her that she's going to be just as responsible. So there's so much that's actually going on that when it doesn't happen in the virtual interview, it's really surprising and suggests to me that the story's becoming a little bit more crystallized, despite it being totally and completely wrong. It's becoming more crystallized, and the boyfriend is there to make sure that it goes the way that he wants it to go.
Want to listen ad-free? Want advanced access to all of our interviews before anyone else?
Become a True Crime Today Premium Plus subscriber on Apple Podcasts.
You get every episode commercial-free,
so you can binge on true crime
until you can binge no more.
Search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts now, or go to our podcast page and sign up now.
More of the Hidden Killers podcast next.